Pastoral Care by St. Gregory the Great. Part 1, Chapter 8. Of those who covet preeminence and seize on the language of the apostle to serve the purpose of their own cupidity. But for the most part, those who covet preeminence seize on the language of the apostle to serve the purpose of their own cupidity, where he says, "If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desires a good work." But while praising the desire, he forthwith turns what he has praised to fear, when at once he adds, "But a bishop must be blameless." And when he subsequently enumerates the necessary virtues, he makes manifest what this blamelessness consists in. And so, with regard to their desire, he approves them. But by his precept he alarms them, as if saying plainly, "I praise what ye seek, but first learn what it is ye seek, lest while ye neglect to measure yourselves, your blamefulness appear all the fouler for its haste to be seen by all in the highest place of honor." For the great master in the art of ruling impels by approval and checks by alarms, so that by describing the height of blamelessness, he may restrain his hearers from pride, and by praising the office which is sought, dispose them to the life required. Nevertheless, it is to be noted that this was said at a time when whosoever was set over people was usually the first to be led to the torments of martyrdom. At that time, therefore, it was laudable to seek the office of a bishop, since through it there was no doubt that a man would come in the end to heavier pains. Hence, even the office of a bishop itself is defined as a good work, when it is said, "If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desires a good work." Wherefore, he that seeks not this ministry of a good work, but the glory of distinction, is himself a witness against himself, that he does not desire the office of a bishop, inasmuch as that man not only does not love at all the sacred office, but does not even know what it is, who, panting after supreme rule, is fed by the subjection of others in the hidden meditation of his thought, rejoices in his own praises, lifts up his heart to honor, exalts in abundant affluence. Thus worldly gain is sought under color of that honor by which worldly gain should have been destroyed. And when the mind thinks to seize on the highest post of humility for its own elation, it inwardly changes what it outwardly desires. Chapter 9. That the mind of those who wish for preeminence, for the most part, flatters itself with a feigned promise of good works. But, for the most part, those who covet pastoral authority mentally propose to themselves some good works besides, and though desiring it with a motive of pride, still muse how they will effect great things. And so it comes to pass that the motive suppressed in the depths of the heart is one thing, and another what the surface of thought presents to the muser's mind. For the mind itself lies to itself about itself, and feigns, with respect to good work, to love what it does not love, and with respect to the world's glory, not to love what it does love. Eager for domination, it becomes timid with regard to it while in pursuit, audacious after attainment. For while advancing towards it, it is in trepidation lest it should not attain it. But all at once, on having attained, thinks what it has attained to be its just due. And when it has once begun to enjoy the office of its acquired dominion in a worldly way, it willingly forgets what it has cogitated in a religious way. Hence, it is necessary that when such cogitation is extended beyond want, the mind's eye should be recalled to works already accomplished, and that every one should consider what he has done as a subordinate. And so may he at once discover whether, as a prelate, he will be able to do the good things he has proposed to do. For one can by no means learn humility in a high place who has not ceased to be proud while occupying a low one. One knows not how to fly from praise when it abounds, who has learnt to pant for it when it was wanting. One can by no means overcome avarice when advanced to the sustentation of many, whom his own means could not suffice for himself alone. Wherefore, from his past life, let every one discover what he is, lest in his craving for eminence the phantom of his cogitation elude him. Nevertheless, it is generally the case that the very practice of good deeds which was maintained in tranquility is lost in the occupation of government, since even an unskillful person guides a ship along a straight course in a calm sea, but in one disturbed by the waves of tempest, even the skilled sailor is confounded. For what is eminent dominion but a tempest of the mind, in which the ship of the heart is ever shaken by hurricanes of thought, is incessantly driven hither and thither, so as to be shattered by sudden excesses of word and deed, as if by opposing rocks? In the midst of all these dangers, then, what course is to be followed, what is to be held to, except that one who abounds in virtues should accede to government under compulsion, and that one who is void of virtues should not, even under compulsion, approach it? As to the former, let him beware, lest if he refuses altogether, he be as one who binds up in a napkin the money which he has received, and is judged for hiding it. For indeed, to bind up in a napkin is to hide gifts received under the listlessness of sluggish torpor. But on the other hand, let the latter, when he craves government, take care, lest by his example of evil deeds he become an obstacle to such as are journeying to the entrance of the kingdom, after the manner of the Pharisees, who, according to the Master's voice, neither go in themselves nor suffer others to go in. And he should also consider how, when an elected prelate undertakes the cause of the people, he goes, as it were, as a physician to one who is sick. If, then, ailments still live in his body, what presumption is his to make haste to heal the smitten while his own face is carrying a sore? End of chapter 9.